1702 from the Northern District of Iowa, United States versus Jose Ramirez Martinez.
All right, Mr. Roth, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you, Judges of the Eighth Circuit, for allowing me to argue the case of Mr. Ramirez Martinez today. The case before us essentially involved two pieces of evidence at trial. Those pieces of evidence were one, some phone evidence admitted through wiretaps that we are arguing should not have been admitted. The other piece of evidence was essentially boils down to cooperator testimony that we're arguing was facially not credible. For these reasons, and as I'll further explain, we're asking for a reversal of Mr. Ramirez Martinez's convictions. As to the first piece of evidence I mentioned, the phone evidence, in our brief and at trial, we were objecting to essentially the text message evidence. And these text messages further can divide down into two types of text messages. One category was messages purporting to be from my client, the appellant, Mr. Ramirez Martinez. And these were admitted as statements by a party opponent. The second type of or subtype of text messages were alleged co-conspirator statements. Now, dealing with the text messages from Mr. Ramirez Martinez, or alleged to be from Mr. Ramirez Martinez, I refer to these in my brief in here as the 6140 messages. The reason for that is that's the last four digits of the phone alleging to be Mr. Ramirez Martinez's. Now, when looking at any statement that's alleged to be from a party opponent, the first thing that the proponent of the evidence essentially has to show is that that person making the statement was the party opponent. Well, lots of times you have somebody who may make a statement on a recording or video or directly to a witness, and it's pretty easy to discern that's the statement from the party opponent. That's the party opponent. But here we're dealing with messages where we don't know who the author is or who is on the other end of the phone. And our argument is that there is insufficient evidence to rise the level of proof needed to show that that was messages from the party opponent in this case.
Counsel, a question, Judge Kobus here, and I don't recall from your brief, is the argument that your client was not sufficiently connected to the phone, or that the particular messages that were admitted are not connected to your client?
I think it's kind of both. And the real argument here is first that he wasn't sufficiently connected to the phone.
Well, I mean, it seems to me there's a fair amount of evidence connecting your client. There's the phone call the law enforcement made. There's the co-conspirator statements saying that they called your client on that telephone number. Why isn't that sufficient to invoke the to support the district court's decision here?
Hello. Hello, Your Honors.
Yes.
Counsel, are you still there? I'm not sure if you heard my question or not, but
I did get the question. I'm sorry. My audio and video cut out on my computer for about 30 seconds. I did get the question about whether the phone number was connected to my client or whether he's the author of the messages. I mean, our argument essentially boils down to both those things, is that he wasn't sufficiently connected to the phone, first, and second, you can't really show that he's the author of those messages.
So I think, Counsel, you missed my second question then, and that was, it seems to me there's a fair amount of evidence linking your client to that phone number. You had the ruse phone call that was observed by law enforcement. You had co-conspirators' statements saying, hey, this is how we got a hold of your client at this phone number. Why isn't that sufficient enough to link your client to that phone number?
Yes, Your Honor. And I guess as far as the ruse phone call goes, again, you know, as we addressed in the brief, there's one out of two ruse phone calls made. He answered during the one ruse phone call, and it's our assertion that that's the only piece of evidence linking him to that phone number.
How about the co-conspirators' statements that they called him on that phone number?
That's right. And the co-conspirator statements were that they called a person named Primo on that phone number. They actually didn't know whether it was Mr. Ramirez Martinez that they were talking to or somebody else. The two people that actually knew Mr. Ramirez Martinez in person, Ms. Salazar and the other guy, Rafael, I can't remember his last name at the moment. Those two didn't identify that phone number as belonging to Mr. Ramirez Martinez. It was only the two Minnesota conspirators or cooperators that identified that number as belonging to Primo. But again, they didn't know who they were talking to on the other end of the line. And so that's why it's our assertion that the only piece of evidence linking Mr. Ramirez Martinez to the phone number is the ruse call, Your Honor. And so, again, we cited in our brief the 10th Circuit, the Brinson case, essentially to show that, you know, there's a level of proof here that needs to be reached to show that somebody can be linked to a certain account or phone number. In that case, it was a Facebook account. In this case, it's a phone number. But again, there's no evidence in this case showing who is the owner of the phone, no address of the account number or the account holder. It was just that one ruse call.
What do you believe the standard of proof is? I mean, because I view this as a preconditional fact question that's ordinarily determined by the trial judge. And so that preconditional fact question is usually just decided with burden of proof being sufficient that a jury could find by the greater weight to the evidence that it has been connected, right? And so it's just sufficient to raise a jury question to a preponderance. Now, is that not true, or is it some other burden?
I would agree that's the burden, Your Honor. It's just our assertion that the evidence in this case didn't meet that burden. That the evidence, as I said, you know, as shown in other cases, needs to be more than the one ruse call out of two different ruse calls, one of which wasn't answered, that could link Mr. Ramirez Martinez to the phone number. So I would agree that's the burden. It's just it was not shown in this case. We're not arguing for any kind of higher burden. Okay. And so, again, as Your Honor said earlier, and the government argues there's other evidence that may link Mr. Ramirez Martinez's phone number. Again, Garcia Jimenez, the one Minnesota cooperator, didn't actually ID the end user of the 6140 number, just knew him as El Primo. The Paseño cooperator, the testimony the government cites in its brief didn't necessarily discuss that Paseño knew the end user of the 6140 number, just said Paseño had driven down to Denison to meet with Mr. Ramirez Martinez. So again, it really comes down to the one ruse call. As far as the text messages of the co-conspirators go, there is a few different categories or subcategories of those messages. There is the Ismael Moreno messages. There's the Duena messages. As far as the Moreno messages go, again, those messages, we didn't really address them much in the brief, but still there's insufficient evidence to show that those were co-conspirator messages that are applicable to this case. One of the, initial burdens the government has to show is that the defendant was part of the conspiracy alleged in those messages or co-conspirator statements. As far as the Moreno messages go, we assert that the defendant wasn't alleged to be part of those. The Duena messages, I think there's even less evidence that the Duena messages were part of the conspiracy. Really, when it comes down to the Duena messages, the only evidence really showing those were in furtherance of the conspiracy were the agent statements or the agent's, subjective opinions about these have to do with drug trafficking.
Counsel, you're running out of time, and it seems to me that even if you prevailed on this argument, there's still plenty of evidence to convict in this case by the testimony of co-conspirators and cooperating witnesses.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I think you're referring to the government's argument that the mission of the messages could be harmless error. As we said in our reply brief, we assert that they are not harmless, that wasn't harmless to admit these text messages. The government's case really came down to these two main pieces of evidence, the cooperator testimony and the text messages. And the admission of the text messages was not harmless because without them, I mean, you have the uncorroborated cooperator testimony. You had the two guys, the Minnesota guys, whose testimony, I mean, almost is essentially worthless without any corroboration from the text messages. The guys who only met Mr. Ramirez Martinez allegedly many years prior on one occasion for each guy. So I guess it's our assertion, as far as those two cooperators go, their testimony would be even more incredible without the text messages. So without the text messages, the cooperator testimony wouldn't be enough. The other two cooperators, Trishina Salazar and the other gentleman from Denison, again, as we argue in the brief, we believe their testimony is likewise not credible. And so, again, when it's just those cooperator testimonies, it's insufficient evidence to find Mr. Ramirez Martinez guilty of the crime. At the end of my argument, so if Your Honors don't have any more questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you very much. And Mr. Wade, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Sean Wade, representing the Northern District of Iowa and AUSA in this particular case. This case was a three-day trial that involved, as we've already outlined a little bit, historical cooperator testimony from four cooperators, co-conspirators, and then seven law enforcement agents, primary case agent regarding the T3 wiretap type or based investigation, although there were other investigative techniques used, and then a number of officers on surveillance activity to help identify participants in the conspiracy and tie up certain, I guess, T3 wiretap intercepts to certain activities of those involved in an attempt to identify those individuals. Case is kind of a three-legged stool, so to speak, in the sense that you have the physical evidence of what was seized ultimately, methamphetamine, corroborating that there was a methamphetamine operation based in Worthington, Minnesota. The head of it, Garcia Jimenez, a.k.a. Magana, was kind of the northern head of the operation. And then it involved the, kind of a southern tier, at least in part, as a part-time and alternative source for Magana that he identified as the defendant and somebody he had known as Primo, somebody he had previously met one time back in 2014, but then got involved with through a co-conspirator named Lopez Zuniga when he needed an alternative source. And then essentially distribution between Denison, Iowa, northward towards Worthington, Minnesota, and then distribution from Worthington, Minnesota, south and around the Worthington in the area. So you had southwest Minnesota, I guess, southeast South Dakota and northwest Iowa, all being served by the Magana-based organization as alternatively sourced, at least in part, for part of the methamphetamine by the defendant. Sufficiency of the evidence is because of that, we argue, is sufficient because of that three-legged stool type of evidence that we have it both from co-conspirators who corroborate each other, who are also corroborated in part by some of the T3 intercepts, who don't all know each other. For example, Rafael Martinez in the Denison area knew the defendant, was introduced to the defendant, distributed methamphetamine to the defendant. He overlapped a bit with Trishina Salazar, and so he knew she got methamphetamine from the defendant. She knew he got methamphetamine from the defendant. He knew him as Primo. She knew him as Carlos. There's testimony that drug traffickers use multiple nicknames. Then you have the northern part. You have Magana, the head of the organization, needed source for methamphetamine, utilized the defendant, was introduced to him by text message or phone, got the phone number, used the phone number. Those intercepts that were utilized were consistent, as testified to by the officer and by Magana, consistent with drug trafficking. And then he utilized Saul Pisano Valtierra as a go-between at least one time to go pick up methamphetamine and identify the defendant. He identified Saul Pisano Valtierra identified the defendant in the courtroom. Magana identified the defendant by Exhibit 1 or a photograph that he had dealt with one time in 2014. Obviously, Trishina Salazar identified him in the courtroom, as did Rafael Martinez. Ms. Salazar had taken methamphetamine as a transporter north towards Magana two times. One time was corroborated by Magana. We also have the intercepted surveillance-based operation that caught an individual by the name of Marino transporting north as well, consistent with Magana's testimony. And then we have Salvatano Valtierra saying that he went down and utilized a hand-to-hand transaction with the particular defendant in regards to that acquisition of approximately anywhere from a quarter pound to a half pound of methamphetamine. Now, the individuals down south talked more about ounces and quarter pounds. The individuals north talked about more about quarter pounds to half pounds, but they talked about repeated conduct with the defendant and in a methodology of having a transporter between the two locations. At first was Lopez Zuniga, the actual initial introducer of that operation between Mr. Ramirez Martinez to Garcia Jimenez, and then later people like Trishina Salazar, like Ismael Moreno, that was observed on surveillance, and then discussed a number of other types of transactions by other transporters that were discussed by Magana and Saul Valtano, Pisano Valtierra. The evidence was, again, multifaceted. It's one of those types of things where you have to hear all of the historical testimony in order to compare and contrast it. You almost have to hear the series of text messages and, I guess, recorded phone calls. There was a couple of those to kind of understand the context, and that's why the court admitted those in this particular case. So the district court did not err in overruling the defendant's motion for judgment of acquittal. I'm going to turn to the text messages, kind of the crux of the defendant's arguments in this particular case. The argument appears to be that there's only one way to identify him originally, and that was the ruse phone call. We submit that that is an error, and incorrect, as I think came up in some of the questioning of defense counsel, that there was more than that, particularly with regard to historical testimony by the cooperators, particularly by Garcia Jimenez, a.k.a. Magana. The court admitted the evidence in three phases. 801 D2A as a party omissions by a party opponent, finding by a preponderance of the evidence, and I know that was an inquiry by the court, finding by a preponderance of the evidence that the government had identified the defendant as the operator of that particular phone. I think the court cited the ruse phone call, but also cited other testimony by the cooperators and other testimony in the case. I would submit that that was not only the other cooperators, particularly Magana, testifying about his communications. This is what these messages meant. Transfer of money, transfer of methamphetamine, arrangements for transportation when they had difficulties doing that. Number of inquiries of when are you going to have money for me, coming from the defendant, and Magana's putting him off and then ultimately making some payments. The additional evidence that is more, I guess, indirect in nature is that the messages showed the officers that there was going to be a transport, I believe transport of methamphetamine, and they did surveillance and did observe Ismael Moreno go up to Worthington. They observed him at Worthington as it was determined he was lost. Agents found him. Magana found him through his second, Pisano Valtierra. Agents observed that individual go to Magana's house and then observed him track all the way back down to through a series of officers to Denison. Magana then testifies, Sal Passano-Valtierra testifies, and the text messages match up and the phone call matches up. I think it's exhibits 117 and 118 as to that guy getting lost and then them leading him to Magana to deliver a half pound of methamphetamine, consistent with Magana's discussions and Sal Passano-Valtierra's discussions as to how these transactions occurred, how they were transported north, and how Mr. Valtierra and then also went down and obtained methamphetamine down south. So there was a variety of different ways in which the defendant was identified as the operator of that phone, Ruth's call, and also the fact that he there was behavior consistent with the delivery of methamphetamine in context of some of those calls, as testified to by Magana and to a certain degree by the case agent. Now I'm going to turn to that was principally 100 level exhibits, 101 to 138, 117 and 118. I believe there was an error in the court's transcripted test order. It was using 118 to 119. But in any event, there were two calls with Marino and Magana that Magana identified and were co-conspirator hearsay as determined by the court. The rest of those were by the defendant and were considered party admissions or party opponent statements and or either reference as to the context or 801 D2E co-conspirator statements. But the 200 level exhibits, 201 to about 222, involve another co-conspirator identified both by Rafael Martinez. In a way, he said Magana, he said the defendant's source was female. Trishina Salazar identified the defendant's source, or at least source that she knew in the past, was a photograph of, she knew it as Duena, the ID identified by the officers in the traffic stop, and the ruse call that she answered the phone that was on the wiretap intercepts was Maria Alvarez. Court found that sufficient to establish her as a co-conspirator. The two co-conspirators actually said that she was a co-conspirator and source for the defendant. And then the agent testified as to the context, actually two agents, but primarily the case agent testified as to the context of those particular intercepts and why they were intercepted, including following or meeting at a location that they believed was a money drop, and then later following her throughout Northwest Iowa to identify her. And then there's a second set of phone calls or text messages thereafter where it's a different phone number, which the agent testified that he had determined that she was the owner of or operator of by open source inquiries. And again, consistent code words, numbers about getting money and when she could get money to the 6140 number operated by the defendant. In the overall context of things, you look at each individual type of evidence, whether it be the 100 exhibits, without other testimony from the co-conspirators, it doesn't make as much sense. The 200 exhibits, maybe the same thing, but in combination, the 100 exhibits, the 200 exhibits, and then the testimony of the officers regarding not only the expertise of drug trafficking, but of the surveillance activity that corroborated the actual intercepts. It's what you want officers to do when they get intercepts is to follow up and do some surveillance as to what activity is being talked about, at least in code. And we were able to verify that in a couple of occasions in this particular case, and that corroborated the co-conspirator statements. Finally, as I think came up earlier in questions to the defense, even assuming, and we're not conceding that here, we think it was all properly admitted in the three ways in which the court did on the transcript, I believe at 455 through about 465. If there were some exhibits that were erroneously admitted, we believe that there would be harmless error in the context of all the historical testimony about direct contact with the defendant by a number of people and indirect contact by others in his drug trafficking activities in Northwest Iowa to Southwest Minnesota. That concludes my comments to the court, unless the court has some questions.
Okay, I guess not. Thank you very much, Mr. White. And Mr. Roth, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points. I'll be brief. One, discussing the government's evidence one more time about the sufficiency. Government talks about the three-legged stool. I understand that there was physical evidence found in the case. Again, there's really no ties of any physical evidence to Mr. Ramirez-Martinez. The evidence against him was the cooperator testimony and the text messages. A second point, I think the government kind of hit upon it in their argument, is going to the point of whether these messages were omitted and whether their omission was harmless error. As the government said, I mean, the messages provide context and corroboration. Again, our argument is that it provides that context and corroboration to the point of really you can't have the cooperative testimony without that other component. And so, again, we believe there's insufficient evidence to have convicted Mr. Ramirez-Martinez, but we are requesting either judgment of acquittal or remand for new trial. Thank you, Your Honors. And that concludes my argument unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your arguments this morning. The case is submitted, and the court will render a decision in due course. You may call the next case.